From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Can the U.S. hold on in Afghanistan? Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Green Berets reportedly are talking to Afghan villagers after the alleged killings of at least 16 people, including 9 children, by an American soldier. The Taliban has threatened reprisals. Tensions are very high, with President Karzai calling the incident unforgivable. In this country, a recent poll shows 60% find the war no longer worth fighting, but political leaders are divided. We'll hear from Kabul and Washington. Can trust be restored? Is the Obama withdrawal strategy likely to change? Later on, the continuing impact of Japan's earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear meltdowns a year ago. What's the future of nuclear power? First, the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Almost all of Japan's nuclear reactors have shut down in the aftermath of last year's meltdowns, and the nation is still struggling to overcome the massive earthquake and devastating tsunami. Later on, we'll hear from Tokyo, and we'll also hear about plans to build new nuclear reactors here in the U.S. First, this news update, U.S. officials are trying to understand and explain why a married U.S. soldier, the father of two, allegedly left his base to murder at least 16 Afghan people asleep in their beds, including 9 children. For the moment, there is unity between 3 major factors in Afghanistan, the civilians, the government officials, and the Taliban. Here in the United States, there is, of course, a concern at the Pentagon and in the Obama administration. Craig Whitlock is Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much.
Interesting reaction or puzzling reaction in one respect by the administration. Hillary Clinton today said she was shocked. The president and the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Panetta, both called President Karzai, but there was no outright apology.
Well, that's right. As you'll recall, after these recent string of incidents involving the Quran burning and killings of U.S. soldiers, both sides were apologetic, particularly after the Quran burning. President Obama did apologize. General Allen, the commander of U.S. and NATO forces there, did the same thing and defended it. Of course, some Republican presidential candidates thought that was a sign of weakness and that the United States shouldn't be doing that. So I'm sure that factored in, at least to some degree, in this case. At the same time, I think they're still trying to sort it out, and I think the military wants to get to the bottom of it before they start apologizing.
What has the Pentagon had to say about who was responsible for these killings?
Extremely little. They have not identified the suspect. They've confirmed it's an Army soldier. Sources, this is not on the record, but sources have said it, as you described, a 38-year-old staff sergeant who's married, had been on 3 previous tours of duty in Iraq. This was his first tour of duty in Afghanistan. He arrived there in December, and he's apparently from the Army's Fort Lewis out in Washington State. But other than that, we don't know his name. We don't know the motive for this. We don't know if he had any history of issues or problems that might have flagged him as a potential risk. We're all waiting for that to come out in the coming days.
What about the nature of his assignment? Where was he exactly? What was his relationship with Afghans where he was?
What we're piecing together is that he was assigned to a small group of special operation forces of Green Berets, who were in charge of what was called a village stabilization operation in a small village near Panjwai in Kandahar province, and that they were there, ironically, to try and build support, build relations with the local village, to set up their own security force, and that he was providing support to these Green Berets. Again, we're sort of trying to piece together exactly what he did, what his role was, but he was there as a support soldier for this other group.
Craig Whitlock at the Pentagon for The Washington Post. We have on the line now Graham Boley, who's a reporter in Kabul for The New York Times. And Graham Boley, thank you very much for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Are you ever able to add anything to what we've heard from Craig Whitlock about the incident itself? Can you tell us what the mood is in Afghanistan at this point?
It's very tense, certainly. We've not seen the fury that brought thousands of people onto the streets in recent weeks after the Quran burning. But still, there's this underlying anger. Certainly down in Kandahar, a lot of anger today. And here in Kabul, spirited debates in parliament and lots of statements from angry politicians demanding some sort of justice. We've been focusing on what exactly happened, talking to people down in Panjwe and what they saw. There's a great doubt among many Afghans about the idea that it was a single shooter. They say they saw many soldiers and helicopters, and lots of confusion about the night of the Sunday, early Sunday morning when the shootings happened. And they're very angry at sort of the U.S. insistence of how they're portraying this. But the coalition here is making very clear that it was one shooter who acted alone in the shootings.
Pentagon reporter Craig Whitlock, back to you. Is there the beginning, at least, of some sort of change in strategy by the Pentagon, or at the moment are they just engaged in damage control?
That's a very good question. This morning in Washington, George Little, who's the Pentagon press secretary, was adamant that there will be no change in the fundamental strategy for Afghanistan. He said that this incident is not going to affect that. He wasn't trying to downplay the seriousness of it, but he was adamant in saying that this would not change his strategy. At the same time, as our newspaper reported today in a poll with ABC News, public support for the war is continuing to decline. There's increasing pressure on the Obama administration to accelerate its timetable for withdrawal and for training Afghan forces. In fact, General Allen, the commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, is in Washington this week and next week to hold strategy sessions with the White House and is supposed to testify before Congress next week. This is all in advance of a NATO summit in Chicago in May, in which the allies are supposed to put their stamp on further details of a withdrawal plan and training the Afghan army.
All right. We're going to take a very brief break and then continue with more on what's going on in Afghanistan and in Washington. Later on, we'll talk about the situation in Japan on To the Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Ollie back with To the Point, still talking about the situation in Afghanistan. And Graham Boley, who's there in Kabul now for the New York Times, what about the idea that U.S. and Afghan soldiers can continue to work together? We've already seen in the response to the burnings of the Quran situations where Afghans turned on Americans and attacked them. What about the level of trust?
A lot of people here say that something has changed. You know, we've had terrible things happen in the past, but that we may actually kind of be in a sort of new era now. And certainly with the deadline of 2014 coming, there's so much uncertainty and insecurity. And then the killings recently, the six killings of U.S. soldiers during the Quran protests has really added to this kind of sense that amongst the soldiers here, but also amongst the kind of U.S. aid workers, lots of them in the country, that they have become targets. And yet that whole process is so important as America withdraws from this country, to make sure it stays whole. So it is very, very important that it does go ahead, and, you know, U.S. officials here are insisting it is. There's a very important moment coming up in a few weeks when private security guards are abolished by President Karzai and a new public protection force comes into place. And there's many, these are kind of guards who protect many of the aid projects around the country, the bridges, the road building. They'll suddenly come under the Ministry of the Interior, and a lot of aid workers are worried about whether they can trust these guards and how that's going to affect economic development.
Graham Boley, again, a reporter in Kabul for the New York Times. Thanks a lot for being on our program today. And Craig Whitlock is still with us at the Pentagon for the Washington Post. You said earlier that there is no indication from the Pentagon that there's going to be any change. But doesn't the Pentagon have to be aware of what Graham Boley just reported about the idea, the sort of general feeling in Afghanistan that something very important has changed?
Of course, and that's something they're grappling with now behind closed doors. I think the Pentagon, their public faces, they want to stick to the strategy that President Obama laid in place. At the same time, this string of pretty horrific incidents over the past several weeks, you know, makes you wonder how long they can keep this strategy, how long they can hold it together. At the same time, I think one reason they want to stick with this strategy is they really don't have a plan B, or at least a one that's a much of a viable choice. Do they hurry up and pull out? That's going to make them look weak when they're trying to negotiate with the Taliban and set things up there. They haven't made much progress on that front, but if they accelerate the withdrawal, that's not going to give the Taliban much incentive to come to the table.
Again, Craig Whitlock is Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post, and thank you very much for being on our program today.
Sure thing.
Today's Washington Post reports on a new poll, again, showing that 60% of Americans no longer find the war in Afghanistan worth fighting. The Obama administration, once again, has indicated no plan at the moment for change, but politicians are divided. Here's former House Speaker and Republican presidential candidate Newt Gingrich.
I think we need to reconsider the whole region. We need to understand that our being in the middle of countries like Afghanistan is probably counterproductive. We're not prepared to be ruthless enough to force them to change. And I think that we're risking the lives of young men and women in a mission that may frankly not be doable.
Another Republican, Senator John McCain, says the U.S. should stay the course.
I understand the frustration and I understand the anger and the sorrow. I also understand, and we should not forget, that the attacks on the United States of America at 9/11 originated in Afghanistan. And if Afghanistan dissolved into a situation where the Taliban were able to take over, or a chaotic situation, it could easily return to a Al-Qaeda base for attacks on the United States of America.
Michael Hirsch is chief correspondent at the National Journal. He's former chief diplomatic correspondent at Newsweek and author of Capital Offense, How Washington's Wise Men Turned America's Future Over to Wall Street. Michael Hirsch, good to have you back on our program.
Oh, happy to be back.
It would appear that the United States is caught in a very difficult situation right now after 1,800 soldiers have been killed, 15,000 wounded, $400 billion spent in the longest war in American history.
Yeah, well, it is. This is the longest war, and it is not having any discernible forward progress, and that's one of the reasons so much political support has been lost. And what's really happened over the last few weeks, culminating in yesterday's horrible incident, is that there is no or very little communication between the U.S. and Afghan forces that is achieving what is the heart of the U.S. strategy, which is to have this gradual and peaceable handover of stability for the country, responsibility for the country, from the U.S. to the Afghan national forces. So with that at least badly damaged, that central element of the strategy, then questions, you know, will have to be raised about, is the strategy at all viable? I mean, even in the best case, it was a long shot.
How long do you think the United States has to reconsider?
Well, I think what people don't fully realize is that this mid-2013 handover, 2014 withdrawal strategy of President Obama's was already a serious compromise on what experts would consider to be really effective nation-building or counterinsurgency-type strategy. Already under the current strategy, Regional Command East, the largest part of the country that's troubled, was getting minimal, at best, counterinsurgency-type aid, which is to say a lot of winning of hearts and minds. That's the whole idea of counterinsurgency. So we already had one foot out before these recent incidents, the Quran burning and the violence that followed, the incident where U.S. soldiers were videotaped urinating on Taliban bodies, and now what happened yesterday. So what this does is really throw into further doubt a strategy that was already marginal.
Michael Hirsch again at the National Journal. Larry Korb is senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. That's a liberal think tank. He was former Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration. Good to have you back on our show as well.
Nice to be with you again, Warren.
What's your take on whether the administration can continue its current plan to slowly and peacefully transition by training Afghans to take over the security responsibilities of American soldiers?
Well, I think this is going to make it very difficult for us to do that, as well as to get their status of forces agreement that allows us to continue the night raids. Everybody's focusing on, 13 and 14, but we want to keep a residual presence there in case the Taliban should get up to their old ways or Al-Qaeda should come back. But, Karzai is insisting no night raids, and I think this will make it very difficult for us to get permission from him to do these raids. And I do think it will, if anything, it will accelerate our turning it over in the negotiations we have with the Taliban, because it was pretty clear that we couldn't win before, but now I think it's going to be impossible for us to buy the time that we need to get the situation we'd like.
How important are the night raids?
Well, I think they're very important because basically that's when, in fact, we go after the Taliban and if Al-Qaeda should come back. I mean, that's kind of become a point of contention. But it reminds me very much in Iraq because everybody focused on the fact we had to get out by the end of 2011. But we had to agree in June 2009, 6 months after we signed the Status of Forces Agreement, to get our troops out of the towns and cities, and they could only go out with the permission of the Iraqis. And I think that's what the Afghans are trying to say, or Karzai, I got to have control of this, and this incident shows what happens, when I don't. Because as your previous guests were saying, a lot of Afghans don't believe it was just a lone, gunman going out, a lone soldier. They think it was just another one of these raids that have killed hundreds of people.
Michael Hirsch, back to you with the National Journal. Haven't there always also been indications that President Karzai himself and the people around him might not really be safe without American troops around?
Well, indeed. I mean, Karzai's anointed negotiator for talks with the Taliban, the former president of Afghanistan, was assassinated by a suicide bomber last fall. And so there are always questions about that. And this is something that is really percolating now, as one of your previous guests pointed out, with the plan to hand over security, aid groups, NGOs, as well as American diplomats are all concerned about what is to follow, particularly since we've seen this violence and the incident in the Interior Ministry a few weeks ago in which two American advisors were shot dead by someone who was their nominal ally and subordinate. So it's a very, very worrisome situation. As I say, it's kind of like the rug has been pulled out from the main point, the main strategic idea behind the U.S. presence there.
So, Laurie Korb, what about politics here? Obviously, in a very sensitive situation with the Republican presidential primary going on, here we heard Newt Gingrich say, essentially, maybe this is not doable, suggesting we ought to get out right away. Here's John McCain saying we need to stay the course lest we leave a chaotic situation that would return Afghanistan to being an Al-Qaeda base. I believe that Mitt Romney has pretty much been on the McCain side of that issue. But this poll by the Washington Post shows that for the first time, rank-and-file Republicans are divided about whether the war is worth it.
And that's right. And you may remember Lindsey Graham, who's very close to McCain, the senator from South Carolina, last week said if Karzai doesn't agree to the night raids or allow us to keep control of the prisoners, we shouldn't keep fighting. Well, because we made a compromise on that, but we are transferring control to them. We're not going to have as much control as we used to. So I think politically, you're not going to get hurt politically if you get out of there, because I think Americans, looking at that poll and looking at this incident, are going to say, for what? What people have forgotten, this young man, this is his fourth tour. He's been in the service 11 years. He hasn't had enough time at home in between deployments. I think we're going to find out he's got, some mental problems. And Fort Lewis there, they've had all kinds of problems and, not taking care of the people with mental disorders. And I think this is something else. The strain on these people, I think it will hit home with Americans. And then, as Michael just pointed out, we don't know what happened, but I can imagine him saying, well, they're killing my friends here, the guys we're training, so, you know, I'm going to take it into my own hands.
So, Michael Hirsch, what about the politics of this? Won't the Republicans be more likely to attack President Obama if he withdraws right away, or will they be more likely to attack him if he continues to persevere in a situation which seems to be deteriorating by the day?
Well, they're going to attack him in either account because they're just finding reasons to do so. But I certainly do think that the waning of Republican support, you know, even extending to someone like Newt Gingrich and possibly Rick Santorum on the campaign trail, support for the Afghan war will make it a little bit easier. I don't think Obama is or can actually, you know, feasibly withdraw right away. But here's the argument they're going to make. I mean, going back to John McCain's comments that you just had on the show, they're going to make the case that, look, we have taken care of al-Qaeda to a large extent. This is not Afghanistan circa 2001, where you have Afghan hosts friendly with al-Qaeda. Here you've got a situation where we've taken out a lot of al-Qaeda, including the leader, Osama bin Laden, and the Taliban are another and a different entity. And they're going to make the case that we can continue to take out the real bad guys, the al-Qaeda guys, and still withdraw our regular troops. And I think you're going to hear many versions of that over the coming months.
But of course, Larry Korb, that leaves the Taliban, and it looks as if the Taliban, which is already knows that we're going to pull out, can just bide its time.
Well, I think it can. I mean, their negotiating position is we have to leave. Our card that we can play is, okay, we won't leave until the situation is stable. So that's basically what we're negotiating. But I think once we started negotiating with them, it was just inevitable that we were going to, you know, be out, and basically, you know, the Afghans are going to have to make the decisions on their own. And the key to me is really that strategic agreement, because we'll be turning over more control to them, but if we have no residual presence, it's very hard for us to control events in there after we leave, which we're going to have to do someday.
Isn't there some feeling, Michael Hirsch, that without the kind of training that American forces would provide, there's no way that the Afghan army could resist the Taliban, or is that too glib a statement?
It's a very, very critical question as to where they are already. I know my colleague Jim Kitfield was there in December, spent a good amount of time near Khost in the Regional Command East, which is the central area that we're concerned about. And there was a general sense then that there was a fragile standoff, that the Taliban were mostly on the defensive against U.S.-aided Afghan forces. But as with Iraq, we don't really know what happens when you remove the element of American guidance at this point. There's a general belief that the Taliban are stronger than the Afghan national forces. But remember, whatever agreements we strike with the Afghan national government, there's going to be continual support and supply from the U.S. for the Afghan forces.
Michael Hirsch, again, chief correspondent of the National Journal. Larry Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Thanks to you both. Thanks to Craig Whitlock and Graham Bowley as well, with the Washington Post and the New York Times, respectively. Japan is still struggling to recover from last year's multiple disasters. We'll be back in a minute to talk about that on To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
We're only back with To the Point. A year ago yesterday, Japan experienced multiple disasters, an earthquake, a tsunami, and the meltdowns of three nuclear reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi plant in the northeastern part of the country. Hitoshi Abe is chair of UCLA's Department of Architecture and Urban Planning. He's also director of the Terasaki Center for Japanese Studies, which is hosting a traveling exhibit, Moving Forward, Life After the Great East Japan Earthquake. He's from Sendai, a city of 1.2 million people, which was upwind of the nuclear plant, but near the coast that was devastated by the quake and the tsunami. Professor Abe, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. And I'm excited to talk to you.
When you return to Japan, particularly to your hometown, Sendai, the biggest city to have been impacted by the earthquake, how much has changed, and what is the state of mind of people there, your own family and others?
Okay, one thing, everybody even in Japan, and there are many people who are not connected to this area, and the memory gets started to be fading. But also there are many people, such as my, for instance, my aunt, who were actually almost taken by tsunami while she was driving. She refused to go back to live in the apartment. She's staying with other people at the shelter still because she's so scared to be alone. She feels more comfortable surrounded by other people. So there's a huge trauma, especially left in the people's mind who are actually who used to live along the coastline and directly hit by tsunami.
Did people you're acquainted with, did people in your own family lose homes and lose businesses?
Yes. As I said, my family is from that area, and my relatives on my mother's side is mostly living along the coastline. So most of them lost their houses and the businesses, and some of people actually had to close down and share their own business and find another kind of job, or they are still living in temporary housing. And it's very difficult because if you have a small business, let's say the laundry or the bakery, you just don't have just a business, but you need a community to sustain your business. They are your customers. But in this case, the whole community is gone, as well as your store. So it's very difficult to reestablish the lost life.
Well, Professor Abe, thank you very much for being on our program today.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Thanks to Hitoshi Abe, the chair of the UCLA Department of Architecture and Urban Planning, a director of the exhibit Moving Forward, Life After the Great East Japan Earthquake. Chester Dawson is senior correspondent for the Wall Street Journal in Tokyo. He's reported on the human impact of the triple disaster, which he says took the lid off all sorts of other questions, including, of course, the use of nuclear power. Chester Dawson, thank you for joining us from Tokyo.
Good evening, or should I say good morning?
Thank you. Professor Abe's family, not downwind of the nuclear plants, suffered mainly from the earthquake and the tsunami. Tell us to what extent we know what happened at Fukushima Daiichi and what the impact was on the country.
Well, we still don't know officially because the government's own investigative bodies are still looking into it and expect to report what they found in June. There was a report by a independent group that was not authorized by the government but did compile a several hundred page paper in Japanese on what they believe to be the causes. There's still some things we don't know. We don't know how much damage was sustained by the plant from the earthquake as opposed to the tsunami. But essentially we know the basics of what went so wrong. On a very fundamental level, the plant lost access to electricity. That may seem counterintuitive because, of course, the whole point of a plant is to produce electricity, but it needs a certain amount to run the cooling apparatus. And the tsunami not only knocked out the primary cooling system, but also the backup system and, more importantly, the diesel generators, which were really the only backup for the plant in case of what they call an SBO, which is essentially a total blackout of the plant. So when that happened and they were unable to get water in to cool the reactors, essentially the fuel rods melted and we had a meltdown, three of them.
Three meltdowns. There were four reactors. One of them wasn't running at the time.
That's right, yes. And actually it's interesting because Fukushima Daiichi has six reactors, but two of the newer ones didn't have the same layout as the four that were most seriously damaged. Primarily their diesel generators were better protected. It was a newer design, and the diesel projectors were inside, the diesel generators were inside the protected building where the reactor is held. At the other older reactors, they were actually outside and exposed to the elements.
How much radiation was spread around the country? How far from the plant, and how long are the consequences expected to last?
Well, we honestly don't know. I mean, we have fairly detailed readings now after the fact, but we may never know because most of the radiation, particularly in the early days when it was heaviest, blew offshore. So there's a wide debate now in marine academic circles about just how much contamination went into the sea and what impact that may have, not only right offshore Japan, but theoretically in a much wider radius. In terms of Japan, we do know that there were several radioactive plumes which spread mostly in a northwesterly direction, which meant that some people who had actually evacuated from areas closest to the plants ran right into these plumes because a very complex and expensive monitoring system that Japan had in place didn't work effectively. We also know that in the ensuing days, the wind shifted south towards Tokyo, and this is all within the first week when the plants are most heavily damaged and were emitting most of the radiation, so that some radiation came as far as Tokyo and some points further south, but it was a much more limited form, and that went away within, or so we're told, a few days when the rains came, and there was a period, you may recall, when you couldn't drink the water in Tokyo. Well, because a lot of that radiation was being washed out into the sewers and drains.
What is the situation now in terms of nuclear power usage in Japan?
Well, it's slowly dying. Be switched back on, but what's happened is that in the wake of the accident, while a lot of these questions about why, what happened, and how it can be prevented are being asked, Japan's other reactors have gone down for regular maintenance one by one. So of the 54 reactors that Japan had essentially operational before Fukushima Daiichi, only two are still in operation. And one of those will go down later this month and the last one next month. So at that point, Japan will have no active reactors online. And there's a big debate in the government now about what they do to try to get those restarted. There's still a very influential nuclear lobby here that believes it's important to have reactors, that, you know, there have been some so-called stress tests that the other reactors Japan has have been put through. Still a lot of questions about whether those are sufficient to guarantee the safety, and the local communities around the plants are very nervous. The politicians in those local areas have not been willing to sign on, but the government in Tokyo, their official policy is that they will be turned on, and their deadline, self-imposed, is before the full heat of summer comes back, when Japan's demand for electricity peaks. That's obviously because people tend to run a lot more air conditioners, and it's a seasonal high point for demand.
You were in the region a day after the earthquake, before the meltdowns were even known about. You were evacuated, but as I understand it, you stayed in contact with a lot of people from there. What about that region now? I know it has been the breadbasket of Japan. Is there any chance of getting it getting agriculture back into a functioning point? Will people elsewhere in the country eat food from that region?
You know, that's a very interesting question, and Japan has got a very divided response to that. Officially, the government is promoting produce from that region, spending a lot of money on ad campaigns and kind of messaging to get the word out that the food is safe, it's being checked and monitored, and you can even go around to certain places in Tokyo, certain free markets or restaurants that advertise, you know, we are proud to sell, produce from that area, even from Fukushima. But at the same time, a lot of people are actively refraining from buying items from that area, particularly Fukushima, just because there's a lot of uncertainty. The government initially said everything was fine, and then over a series of weeks and months, immediately after the accident, it turned out that the rice wasn't safe, the mushrooms from that area weren't safe, there were a bunch of seafood items that were determined later to be unsafe, and essentially, basically, it was up to the farmers' collective to decide whether the stuff was safe or not initially, and that caused a lot of misgiving. So to this day, you know, some people, especially, I would say, older people who are beyond the so-called highest risk age limit of you know, they say it's arbitrarily, but it's about 40, actively want to support the region, the support farmers there, and are buying the things. But among another class of particularly younger Japanese, Families with young children, you find the exact opposite. They go out of their way to avoid it, pay higher prices for produce from southern Japan or even imported produce.
You live in Japan. What's it like for you?
Well, it's, you know, initially it was a little scary, to be totally honest, because I was in the initial days after I came back to Tokyo from being up in Fukushima, I was with the a detachment of Marines that were sent up there. And, you know, these guys were fully decked out for, you know, essentially the day after. I mean, they were getting reports from the U.S. 7th Fleet, which is based offshore, and U.S. military bases that were running flights over Fukushima, saying, you know, what we're hearing officially doesn't jive with our readings. You know, the readings are off the charts, whereas the Japanese government was telling everyone to remain calm, that, you know, you shouldn't panic. You know, it was quite some time before they actually were able to confirm there were meltdowns. So, you know, for my situation, I kind of felt like I wasn't in great personal risk. I felt because I was generally with experts, although, you know, I wound up having to throw away all the clothes that I was wearing when I was up right in the immediate vicinity of the plant. And I did kind of wonder if I should get myself checked. You know, as far as my family goes, and certainly my relatives in the States were pretty beside themselves, saying that, you know, I had to leave, I had to get my family out of there. So I think, you know, it's been right now, I think, a year on, most people living in Tokyo are not that concerned. The government says it has things under control there. The plants are not bleeding radiation like they once were. But, you know, if there's another giant earthquake, as some have forecast for, you know, this part of the country, or another tsunami and those plants get swamped and they lose electricity again, you know, who knows? So it is a little, it's an odd feeling, you know, you're never quite sure what tomorrow's going to bring. For the past few months, it's been essentially better news, but it's a far cry from the kind of very safe and comfortable existence that, you know, we thought we had in Japan prior to March 11th last year.
Chester Dawson, again, senior correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, who lives in Tokyo. We'll come back to him and talk further about the future of nuclear power in Japan itself and elsewhere around the world. Japanese companies are still promoting nuclear technology elsewhere, and there's some controversy about that. In the meantime, here in the United States, there has, for the first time in 30 years, been issued by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission licenses for new plants to be started. Dr. Stephen A. Smith is executive director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. That's a nonprofit group working on climate change issues in southern states, also opposed to the new plans. Dr. Smith, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to be on.
Have we learned whatever lessons so far we know from Fukushima Daiichi?
Well, I think we're still learning. As the former guest told, there's still information that needs to be analyzed from this tragedy. And to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission's credit, they did respond quickly. They did develop a task force that looked at the near-term understandings of Fukushima, and they came up with 12 broad recommendations. And they then broke those recommendations into what they call tiers, and they have adopted some of the earlier, easier to engage recommendations with members of the industry. But they've kicked the can down the road on some of the other ones that are going to take a lot longer to implement, and they've failed to address some of the real fundamental patchwork issues that we have in the United States that we haven't incorporated in. And the fear is that what happened in with Three Mile Island, what happened after 9/11 for the industry, that they make promises that they're going to implement some of these things, and then years and years go by and they never get implemented. So I think we're unclear exactly what's going on, but the lessons learned, I think, are still being developed.
The only member of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission who voted against new licensing for plants was the chairman, Gregory Jasko, who said, "We're a long way from applying all the lessons learned from Japan." What do you mean, Dr. Smith, by addressing fundamental patchwork issues?
Well, there are, in the United States regulatory regime that they have for nuclear reactors, there are what they call design basis, which means the reactors were designed to withstand certain parameters, and then there's what's called beyond design basis. And then there's also this concept called defense in depth, where you have redundancies that protect things from spiraling out of control. What we know for a fact is that Fukushima really blew open both the beyond design criteria and the defense in depth questions, and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission has dabbled in those areas, but they have not fundamentally addressed beyond basis, which means if you have a plant that was designed to withstand an earthquake and some other event, if the earthquake exceeds that or a series of events come together that create an out-of-control scenario, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission doesn't really have a good way for dealing with that. And most of them said they were so low risk that these would happen that we didn't really need to worry about it. But Fukushima, the failures there on a catastrophic scale really raised these questions again. Could you have a series of events that overwhelm the defense in depth, particularly when you have multiple reactors at a site and particularly when you have reactors of different ages and different conformations? And so the U.S. Regulatory Commission has elements of how to address that, but they haven't looked at it comprehensively. And I think that's one of the biggest criticisms we have and others have had, is that they haven't taken a comprehensive look at it and they aren't implementing the responses to these on a systematic basis. And we're afraid that as we move further away from this event, that the industry will lobby aggressively to keep the cost downs and back the regulators off, and they may never get done. And we've seen that happen historically.
How do people in Georgia near the sites of the new plants feel about it?
Well, there's definitely a mixed feeling. There are those who have economic interest in it and have not really studied the issue that still believe that it's either good for their local economy, that they're going to see the jobs coming from this, or that they have sort of bought into the talking points that nuclear power is safe and cheap and this, that, and the other. But those who have really studied this, I think Fukushima really caused them to reconsider. And you've seen a backing away of commitments to some of this across the board, where a lot of people were beginning to think that nuclear power was indeed a key element of our energy future. I think that it really depends on who you speak with. The biggest thing, though, to tell you that's really damaged the U.S. nuclear power industry in the last few years, although Fukushima has contributed, has been low natural gas prices, a weak economy, and an absolute lowering of other technologies like renewable energy and energy efficiency costs, because the need for these plants has somewhat evaporated and therefore the justification for rushing forward. So the so-called U.S. nuclear renaissance is really not going forward like advertised, and really only one or two reactors are now being seriously contemplated, whereas three or four years ago, there was as much as 18 or 20.
Should point out that both the president and the Republican Party have been enthusiastic about continuing to make nuclear power a part of the mix here in this country. Again, Dr. Stephen A. Smith is executive director for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Scott Peterson is senior vice president of communications for the Nuclear Energy Institute, which advocates in Washington for the nuclear industry. Scott Peterson, good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Good morning.
Good morning to you. What do you say to what we just heard from Dr. Smith, that he's concerned that, first of all, as is the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, not enough has been done since Fukushima to implement what has been learned there, and number two, that as time goes on, the promises being made about the future and about gearing up for the beyond design situation may be backed away from because of pressures from your industry?
Well, I disagree with that part of his statement, but I do agree with Dr. Smith that the steps that we're taking are going to take us several years in terms of learning all of the lessons from Fukushima. But with that said, we started as an industry in the days right after the accident in Japan, triple-checking all of our safety systems, triple-checking our ability to withstand significant natural events, and have done the most exhaustive review of the Fukushima accident that's been done to date, looking really at the first 4 days after March 11th and what actually happened at the site, so that we have the best idea possible about the steps that we can take in the U.S. industry. We've shared that data with the government and with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, And we are now in the process of putting forth a broad industry program that is already taking delivery of additional safety equipment at our sites even before the NRC has put its formal requirements to our companies. So we're not sitting back and waiting for our regulator to give us specific instructions. We knew there are things that we can do to add yet another layer of safety at our sites, mostly adding portable equipment that can help our sites cope with the two basic issues that we saw in Japan, and that was the lack of power and the availability of cooling systems. So we've already either taken delivery or ordered 400 large pieces of backup safety equipment that will put out our sites and in some cases add a fifth power supply to those sites and additional cooling capacity that if for some reason we did have multiple extreme natural events at our sites, we could continue to have the power to supply cooling to our reactors.
One of the authorities in Japan has said Fukushima was prepared for every earthquake known in the last 1,000 years, but it was struck by the earthquake that happened 1,140 years ago. How do we know the same situation isn't going to occur in the U.S.?
Well, one of the things we do in the industry is take the natural events that have happened in this country, analyze them specifically for those regions, and continue to update analysis. And one of the key issues coming out of Fukushima is how do you prepare for the worst earthquakes possible? We look at the worst earthquakes or flooding or natural events, we design to that, and then we add another margin of safety into that design.
I'm going to interrupt you. Excuse me for that. We need to take a very brief break, and we'll come right back.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW.
Well, I'm only back with To the Point, talking about the aftermath of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear meltdowns in Japan and the future of the energy industry here in the United States. Very quickly, Scott Peterson, we're almost out of time. Do you think there will be other plants sited in the United States in addition to Plant Vogtle, the one in Georgia?
Absolutely. There's another site in South Carolina that we believe is on the verge of getting its construction license from the NRC. And then we expect there'll be a little bit of a slower process going forward because of the factors that Mr. Smith identified, the low price of natural gas in particular. But we will see a point roughly after 2020 when we will see significant more nuclear energy development because it's the only large-scale source of electricity that doesn't produce greenhouse gases. And as we see the nexus of energy and environmental policy coming together and really the need to take further controls on carbon, nuclear energy is going to continue to be the most vital source of electricity production we have to meet those two needs.
But there is an economic problem of another kind, it seems to me, because so few investors are willing to invest in nuclear power that the industry has to demand federal loan guarantees in the billions of dollars. Is that always going to be necessary?
Actually, we've seen the reverse be true with the South Carolina project, which is not using a loan guarantee from the federal government. And for every tranche of financing that it's gone to the market for, it's been oversubscribed, okay, sometimes by a factor of 4 or 5.
Dr. Smith, quickly, do you think it's safe to install new nuclear power plants in the United States?
Well, I think the good news is that we have other options. We don't have to go down this route. I mean, we heard this long-winded explanation of all the things that we have to do to prevent these type of accidents. I think we can go with cleaner resources, and I just think nuclear power is going to fade away over time because we're going to see other sources step forward that are going to be cleaner and safer.
But Chester Dawson, back with you in the Wall Street Journal in Tokyo, that's not happening around the world. Many countries now are beginning to install nuclear power, and they are being urged to do so by, among others, Mitsubishi and Hitachi companies in Japan.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, it's interesting that the old school powers in when it came to nuclear energy, which were Westinghouse and General Electric, have basically either been bought out by Japanese partners or are working close with them. You know, GE and Hitachi have a very tight relationship where they're going around the world bidding for projects, mostly in developing countries, although not exclusively. Japan's Toshiba bought out Westinghouse's nuclear operations. So there's a lot of legacy plants in some parts of the world that they are selling replacement parts for and proposing new reactors to. And then in addition to that, there's There's large parts of Eastern Europe that remain very interested in Japanese technology, or this legacy technology that Japan now controls, and many developing nations, particularly Vietnam, where Japan has signed an agreement. They will build two Japanese reactors. Remains to be decided which company's technology they'll use, but you know, Japan remains very aggressive from the prime minister on down on promoting its nuclear technology globally, even though in Japan the prime minister has already ruled out building any new plants. And as we discussed earlier, whether the existing plants are ever turned on again is still an open question.
Okay. We'll have further programs on this subject, which is so rich with issues. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. Chester Dawson in Tokyo with The Wall Street Journal, Stephen A. Smith with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, Scott Peterson with the Nuclear Energy Institute. Our producers, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, Anna Scott, Caitlin Schamberg, Technical Director Mike Newport. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.